Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to this episode of the Weekly Zeitgeist. These are some of our favorite segments from this week, all edited together into one nonstop infotainment laugh extravaganza. So without further ado, here is the Weekly Zeitgeist.
Well, speaking you guys, it's a banger. Just Miles, a second episode back, but we thought he was ready. We had to do it to him. We had to do it to them. We're thrilled to be joined by the Cold Brew Kraken, as producer Justin.
Yeah.
As we were letting him into the chat, he was like, unleash the Kraken, unleash the Cold Brew Kraken.
Cold Brew Kraken.
Mr.
Yes.
Cold Brew got me like the advice king. The poetry window is open because it's Chris motherfucking Crofton!
Chris! Hey, what's up?
What's up?
Thank What's you so up, much, man? Jack. Thank you for that. That's like, you know, when you see a stand up and they play like Enter Sandman or something, and then you know they're coming on stage and then it goes away and everybody's like, oh yeah, it's a comedy show.
It is that there is that moment. I know exactly what you're talking about, where like the song comes on, you feel like you're at a baseball game because you're like, oh, here comes the bat.
Oh yeah.
And then you got like the music fades down. You're like, all right, y'all, how you guys doing tonight? How you guys doing tonight? All right, you guys on some dates tonight? And you're like, fuck. Just like,
what do you do, sir?
Yeah.
Fuck. God.
Whoa.
Damn.
What do you do, sir?
Hey, this what about you, long hair? What's up? With the Grateful Dead in town? Come on.
Hey,
all right.
Come on. Hey. Am I right? Come on.
Like, he was going hard with that AC/DC before he came in.
That's how it felt. That's how it felt. That was such a good introduction.
Well,
that was an incredible fucking rap by Miles there.
Yeah,
I know.
I felt like I was at a show.
Yeah, all I can talk about now is feces and breast milk. So
I wanted that show to go on. I wanted to hear the rest of that song.
Man, that was I was actually opening for another comedian. So that's what that song was going to go into. Chris Crofton coming to the stage. Bob, 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 Bob.
Yeah. Hey guys, you sick of Republicans or what?
You're dancing to Ludacris's roll out.
Republicans. Man. I feel like they don't got a brain in their head.
You guys heard about Mitch McConnell?
Yeah.
God damn it. That song was better. Put back
kinda
on
looks
Enter-
like a lizard. He like gets the thing wrong instead of turtle. He goes, turtle. He doesn't even have the.
He's like an iguana, huh?
Oh, man. I wish we were listening to Informer still.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Crofton, Informer.
You know, so I'm
saying, oh, man, this is going to rule. So I grew up in Connecticut.
You guys ever been to Connecticut?
You heard of the Vanderbilt Press? Okay.
First of all, you can get my book at a website. Hold on, I have it written down.
No, plug the book after the set. Plug it after the set.
www. Hold on a second.
Open up with some plugs.
I'm going to open with some plugs real quick. Shout out to the DJ for playing.
What else do I have? What else do I have?
What else?
That's a good opener.
What else?
Let me find my phone here.
First words or what else?
Oh, first word, what else?
Yeah.
That's a strong. He went with a first word, what else?
He went a what else opener.
Flashbacks to 2014 Los Angeles. Me showing up age 40 fucking. God damn. And age 40 fucking goddamn. And, you know, just entering, you know, Nashville legend, showing up to start all over at open mics in Los Angeles at age 45. Sure. And I'm like, what is everybody treating me like such a weirdo for? You know, why are these 22-year-olds fucking being such dicks?
That's
like
LA.
They're God. I can't believe
LA.
I mean,
why are these 22-year-olds?
Imagine how
being
old
such dicks.
I must have looked to them. You know how old a 45-year-old is when you're 22.
Oh yeah.
It's like being dead or 100.
Although I remember when I was 22, everyone over the age of 30 seemed like the same amount of old to me. It was like 30 to 60 was just old. And then,
I remember I remember doing drugs with someone that was in their 40s and I couldn't believe that they did. Like, I was like, yo, you party? I'm like, you're 40 though. They're like, yeah, dude, my life's been fucked up for longer than you've been alive. And I was like, oh, okay, cool.
Oh no. Got real dark on it. Yeah. Real grizzled.
I was like, all right.
If you're still doing drugs with 20-year-olds in your 40s, it's coming from a dark place, presumably.
Yeah, my
life's been fucked up since before you were shitting in diapers, kid.
Oh,
yeah, I was
cool.
doing that in 2000. Cool. I was doing that in 2011.
There you go.
Then I got my shit together and went straight to open mics.
There you go. I got to ask you, Doug, what is something from your search history that's, you know, reveals something about what you're into right now?
And if you looked at my search history, it would basically be things like pain, top of foot, hip. Mm. Muscle pain. I'm a big runner. I run a couple marathons, but I'm also old. I'm going to be 50 next year. And so any run that I come back from usually results in a search of like, what was that? Basically. Right. Yeah.
Are you one of those runners where like the first mile and a half, you got to just blow all the pain out of your legs and then you settle in? Or you kind of like every time I run, the first mile is absolutely, it's like my body. Like I feel like that scene in Forrest Gump when his leg braces are breaking off.
I would say the first two or three miles of any race that I do, any run that I do, is just like the warm up, which is a real problem if you're doing like a 5K because that's basically 3 miles.
Right.
But yeah, that's pretty much me.
Okay, got it. And then wait, what's the top of the foot pain?
Oh man, like you know,
your metatarsals acting.
You know your stuff, metatarsal. Yeah. You know all that kind of stuff, and then bottom of the foot, plantar fasciitis, all that stuff. You should see my apartment.
What are you heel striking? Like what's your form like? You heel striking? Can we get some
heel strike a little
video?
Bit too much? Yeah, a little bit too much.
Okay.
Yeah, my apartment's like a physical therapist's office. I've got like the foam pads, the TheraBands, and like the wobble boards and all of that stuff. So I'm constantly trying to like figure. You know, one thing breaks, you fix it, and then the next thing breaks. Like I'm like an old car, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, I got some hip flexor pain. I'm trying to get.
Basically, right now. Yeah, we're sitting too much too. That's the big problem.
Yeah, exactly. Andrew, you have, I know you're a physical specimen, so you probably.
Oh, no, I actually can't run. I've had two knee surgeries.
Really?
Wow. So, yeah, I've had two knee surgeries, but between the one and two, and I'm sure that led to number two, I like wouldn't stop kickboxing. So like, wasn't great, probably.
They're like, man, your patella can't handle any more of these kicks. Bro.
It really was not ideal. And wrestling too, are just like, why are we doing it? I shouldn't be doing that.
Wow.
So I'm bad. I'm just like at least earlier in my life, I was like, I'll just get new knees.
Just run down to the store, pick up a spare set of gloves and
an MCL.
Yeah.
By the way, not wise advice for anyone listening to this who still has good knees.
I know, man. I fucked my knee up terribly when I worked at Playboy. There was a staff party at the mansion that they would have every year. And there's like a hill at the Playboy Mansion. I know it was a terrible fucking place to work. Trust me. I worked there with Jamie Loftus. We were there at the same time. It was kind of a crazy situation. But they set up this slip and slide that's on a very steep hill. And I went down this thing full speed. And when I hit the fucking like backstop of it, I almost like full hyperextended my shit. Cause like it was so, the speed I hit it was so intense. And I, for a second, like I went to a doctor and they're like, you know, you may need surgery, because I was playing a lot of soccer at the time. Like, if you want to do that, like, and kind of recover. And I was like, well, what happens if I don't? And he's like, you could try and let it heal. It's like not so bad that you couldn't just like stay off it and see what happens. And I opted for staying off it. And I've stayed off it for many years now to the point where I'm like, maybe I need to get this shit going again.
Let's move on to our next question. What is something you think is overrated?
College degrees.
Okay, go on.
I didn't graduate from high school. I didn't go to college. And I'm not bragging about that. But, you know, I wrote about this in my book. I lied about it all the time in order to get jobs. I said I was George Santos, basically, like I said.
Fake it till you make it.
I padded my resume because I wouldn't have gotten the job without it. But I was, without that on paper qualification, I was still qualified to do the job. I had the experience. I understood how to do it. I'm a quick learner. Like I educated myself about the position before I got it and then went all in and I did really well. So I don't think I needed that piece of paper in order to do the job, but there's this consensus that we do need that. And a lot of people in my family that are successful don't have college degrees. And I'm not discouraging anyone from getting it, but I do think they're overrated.
Yeah, well, I think there's just like this disconnect too, where there's this emphasis about having it, yet it's so hard to attain or in a way that doesn't potentially fuck you up for decades to come.
Yeah,
I get that. It's like that so many people now, like I was just talking to somebody, I was watching like the Final Four tournament and I was like, I almost went to the University of Miami because like I got in my mind, I was like, yo, I'm a fucking party in Miami for college. Then I saw what it costs and I was like, oh, I'm going to keep my ass in the fucking state because I absolutely couldn't, especially when I saw my other friends taking on loans and like what the payback sort of structure looked like. Mm-hmm. I was frightened to the point where I was almost like, I know I want to get into comedy and shit, but my grandparents and my parents' voice rang in my head. They're like, look, if you could go for it and if you fuck up, at least you could teach history because you have that degree. And I'm like, and I would do that if things shook out a different way. So I see that.
Yeah, it's so, because it's like, nominally, it's supposed to be like proof that you did something or you accomplished something, you're at a level. But like, because of the way the world works, there's so much variance in what that fucking piece of paper means. Like, I feel like I did unfortunately go to like a nice college, and like truly the only thing I learned from that college that I find was valuable was that rich kids are not only not better than you, they are actively worse than you. They are the dumbest people on earth. And we all have the same piece of paper at the end of the day.
Right.
You know?
Right. That's hilarious.
I just like to like, I always think about when, you know, you have a resume or whatever and they ask for like your education. You're like, how many times has anyone ever actually bothered to check up on that? Unless like you came in and they like you were so flagrant with it. They're like, there's no way this person has like a master's from whatever college.
But right.
Other than that, ridiculous. Like to your point, I'm like, yeah, just fake it till you make it. You know,
I don't even know where my diploma is.
Oh, I didn't even get one.
Yeah.
I didn't even walk.
Yeah.
You didn't get a diploma?
No, I was so over, man. I was so over academia because part of me was like, what the, like, I was already becoming like this cynical person about like what a degree meant. And I'm like, but, and then I had like survivor's guilt. I'm like, how come I can get a degree, but these other kids can't get a degree? And then they got to do this. And then they go up in the job. Like, and then we're all going up in the same job interview where you like, you need 17 years of experience for this job. And you're like, I'm 17 though.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like,
yes.
So anyway, all that to say is when it's UCLA, so it was hot in LA in the summer, like beginning, and it was all going to be outdoors. And I asked my parents too. I was like, "You want to wait out there, like to be called amongst hundreds of names?" And they're like, "If you don't care, we don't care." And I'm like, "I don't care." Now, and if you want it, we can buy the diploma, but that's more money. And I would rather just stop giving this UC system my money.
Yes.
So I can walk. Yeah, that way I could walk head first in 2007 into a recession with my degree and go, hey, I got this degree to enter the middle. Well, what the fuck is happening?
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's very. I talk about this a lot with other millennials about how, like, especially like there's so many people who get so down, like, because everything is so difficult to attain right now for younger people, and we're fed this thing of like, well, you should be doing this by now, without understanding like how uniquely of a shitty situation we came of age in, where it was almost like, oh yeah, like I was standing on the rug as it was getting yanked out. What's something you think is underrated?
things being overrated.
Go on. What kind of things?
I've never come on here and not done one that was just like food that I just thought of, where I was right, like, right. To, because I started to think, I was like, I'll do that. But I was like, no, I already did that. I think I already said like fried onion strings are underrated or whatever.
Oh. Wait, what? Oh, as like a side dish?
Yeah, like, I was going to do like fries. Onion? I was going to do like fries are overrated, onion rings are underrated. But then I was like, I think I already said that on here. And also
remember.
Fries are... But fries are not that. Overrated. That's like a lie. I would right. just be saying it. That's a
lie. You're just saying, right, right. You're just saying, just we like got to give saying, some more attention to the onion ring, folks.
Yeah, like onion rings are underrated, but fries are rated correctly.
Onion rings or onion strings?
Well, both. Like, all you, fried
but
onions.
If you had to choose.
I had some really fucking good fried onions the other day
uh-huh.
at this place, Ototo in Echo Park. That's like
Ototo.
A...
Is it a Japanese place?
Yeah, the Japanese place.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I got,
that makes sense.
I got fried onions there, and they were like spring onions. And they were tempura spring
Ooh.
Onions.
Oh,
and
yeah,
just like a plate,
yep.
yeah.
plate of like onion spears, basically, just like flash fried. And they were so Ugh. Fucking good. And it was also what I wanted it to be, which was like a slightly high-end Bloomin' Onion.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah,
Wait,
like
what,
it just tasted wow. like a Bloomin' Onion, but it, like a little like delicate.
But beautiful.
Bloomin' Onion.
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's funny because Ototo is also like a Japanese cracker that I loved as a kid that was like whale and like nautical shaped. But oh. I like that. There's, but it's also like something you'd say like if you're like, oh, oh like whoops, like or something's about to for the Ototo. Like it's kind of how you deploy that that phrase. Dope. But anyway, man, I love onion strings. I'm going to just say that. If
I love
a good
strings.
Onion string, love sometimes they're rings, strings. Like when they're just like the frozen
they're
kind.
Too
like
thick sometimes the ratio of the batter.
The batter
to the
can
onion,
be a little yeah, bit fucked it's, up.
It's yeah. too much. It hurts All my right. stomach. Like too much batter.
Okay. Well, good to know. I will. We'll make sure. That's how we need tempura.
It's just greasy.
Battered everything.
You know what I'm saying?
The tempura, it was light. It was
yeah,
crispy.
Like,
yeah.
It was perfect.
Ugh.
I love
mean,
tempura veggies. Love
You gotta fuck with it.
Yeah, I mean, look, we can eat anything if it's deep fried. I believe in ourselves as a species. All right, let's take a quick break, and we're gonna be right back to talk about the news after this.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back, and just wanted to continue on something that Andrew brought up yesterday when we were talking about Representative Tim Burkett or Burchett from Tennessee, who was asked a very direct question about, you know, school shootings and what Congress's role in it, which he said, I don't really think we have a role at all. And then more importantly, when, you know, this journalist was like, well, you're clearly acknowledging the danger. How do you think we protect people like your daughter you just mentioned? And this was his answer.
What should be done to protect people like your little girl from being safe at school?
Well, we homeschool her, but, you know, that's our decision. Some people don't have that option, and frankly, some people don't need to do it. I mean, they don't have to. It just suited our needs much better.
So this has brought on a lot of conversation around homeschooling, because this is like the new response from the GOP. Rather than gun control, it was either like, it's a mental health crisis, but we're not going to fund it, or it's, yeah, maybe that's why you shouldn't be in fucking schools. And a lot of people, like I said, we're like, to your point, Andrew, you're like, this is all like, that was the perfect answer for the GOP, because A, you're being like, I'm offering a terrible solution that's actually privatization.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think a lot of people were just sort of like, this is just an absolute absurdity, because when you're talking about school shooting and the answer is to protect them with homeschooling, that's, again, like he said, not a possibility for everyone, and also not a fucking solution to the problem.
It's bad for some. It is like a little, look, I know that when they're like, don't politicize the school shooting, it's like just a talking point and it's bullshit. But it is a little like amazing how effortlessly he pivoted from this tragedy to just a different talking point.
Yeah.
That, like, politicizing it in a admittedly unique but perfect for these scumbags way. It's like, you know,
yeah,
I guess he stayed on message.
Yeah, like, okay, so after Uvalde last year, multiple conservative and right-wing, like, far-right publications were putting out op-eds that were like, man, extolling the virtues of homeschooling. They're like, this is the real practical fix for school shootings. One headline was, homeschooling surges as parents seek escape from shootings, violence. Another one said, tragedies like the Texas shooting make a somber case for homeschooling. And in that, it says, you know, it sort of starts off saying tragedies like the shooting in Texas are heartbreaking, but far too common. But to protect the most precious, innocent lives among us, parents must educate their kids at home. Now, a lot of parents in Uvalde did opt to homeschool their kids, which I understand, because that was a total collapse and failure of any system of safety that, you know, you could have hoped for. But this is just such a bad faith argument. And it's really not even talking about like the benefits of homeschooling so much as, to your point, it's about weakening public education.
Well, they just want to basically give all the money that they're spending on public education to these homeschoolers, right? Like, you know, if you want to homeschool your kid, fine. Like, that's your choice. Yeah. You can do it. But you shouldn't necessarily get public money, taxpayer dollars, to go do that, because it takes taxpayer dollars out of the school system and makes our schools worse. Exactly. And this is just, they're, like you said, they're politicizing this thing to just advance the school choice goals that they have to weaken and ultimately destroy public schools. I went to public schools as a kid and I got a great education. My kids go to public schools. We should be funding them 1,000 times more than we are now. But that's not that doesn't jive with the Republican agenda. So here you go.
Well, and they love anything that would repeatedly make a public school seem like a unsafe place. And conversely, or the other side of it too, is like, we'll be like, well, this private school has, you know, former Mossad agents guarding the exterior of it, so I feel like my child will be safe there. But again, you're looking at all these disparities, and the other part of it too, like, you know, and reading this one piece in Jezebel, which like is a really main a huge point too, is a lot of women most likely will probably end up staying home to educate the kids, so we are fully like we're regressing, and it's like a very efficient way to regress that like it incentivizes privatization and reinforcing these like old like gender roles,
and it gives half or whatever of the population a shitty like education that is like clearly politically biased. I will throw out one possibility, which is that like in a law of intended unintended consequences style, I do think if every one of these right-wing goons took their kids and private or homeschooled them, it actually probably would reduce school shootings, because I'm just gonna throw this out there, those are the kids that highly over-index for being school shooters.
Yeah, it's definitely like, when you look at the problem, right, like just like with our gun problems, right, we have so many guns, but a lot of gun violence happens inside of people's homes.
I mean, yeah, I was going to say, like, the most safe place that most kids can be for most of the day is at school, despite these high profile and very scary school shootings. Like, there's not just guns at home, but there's abusive parents at home. There's all kinds of stuff that, like, there, you know, a lot of kids here in New York City, we have a lot of homeless kids who go to public schools and they only get like breakfast and lunch because they go to school. Like it's safer for a lot of kids to be in a public school than it is at home.
And what's wild is even like the Coalition for Responsible Home Education, right? They're like this nonpartisan group that's like they advocate for homeschooling and stuff like that. They pointed out, they're like, I don't know if that's a solution to fucking school. They were like, that's not really this. I mean, we advocate for it, but that's not the solution. And they pointed out, at least 156 homeschooled children have been murdered in homeschooling environments over the past two decades, which is a rate higher than that of their public school peers. So again, no one's saying that it's like bad, but it's so deregulated that it leaves kids, especially like, as they point out, uniquely vulnerable to abuse and neglect. And then also, like, again, it avoids the actual issue that has to be addressed, which is guns.
Too many guns.
Too many fucking guns.
I'm not speaking for the podcast, but I am saying homeschooling is bad. Just FYI.
I'll say this. I remember I like was in a couple youth sports and like youth like art programs with some kids that were homeschooled. And they were definitely socialized in a completely different manner than I was. Like I remember one kid, his whole vibe, like we were 12. I thought he was like 40 years old. Like he lost he was like so buttoned up. You know what I mean? And had no like, cause he wasn't around other kids to like know what fucking around looked like. And then we would be fucking around. He's like, I don't know if this is actually good. We're like, what? But again, it's
are reasons and there are edge cases for everything, but I'm comfortable saying I think it's broadly bad, not necessarily your opinion.
I'm more on the Andrew side than not.
At the end of the day, if there's a binary that I have to choose between, it's public schools all fucking day and it's paid these motherfucking teachers at least 60-70k a year. They have to be fucking living, because that's the other insidious part of this whole thing too, is they're trying to completely demoralize people that want to be in education by being like, yeah, man, you're not going to really have a lot of resources at your disposal. Still like to do it. Could also do something else. So it's it's a slippery slope. So let's talk about some of the alternatives to these public schools that a lot of people like, which is charter schools. And again, not all charter schools are bad, but I do want to point out this charter school in Volusia County, Florida. This principal had to resign after she wrote a check to Elon Musk, because it was a science sort of focused tech magnet. And she really wanted to get a leg up on, you know, the other schools and being like, you know, it'd be great if Elon Musk was fucking with this school. And let's just hear from this local news report.
McGee says she spent months talking to someone she thought was Elon Musk. She was hoping to get the space pioneer to invest millions in the school in exchange for a $100,000 upfront investment. The school's business manager got wind of what happened and canceled the check before it was cashed. But tonight, at a sometimes chaotic and packed school board meeting, other school administrators say McGee was repeatedly warned it was a scam and laid out other issues they say led to a toxic work environment. When employees said they could no longer work under Dr. McGee, McGee resigned and left the building.
Oh, man. Oh, no.
So this poor boomer, she thought, she just went, oh, Elon Musk? What? I'm talking to Elon. This is like the classic, you'll invest in our art school, but only for an upfront like investment of $100,000.
This is like the email you get from a friend, you know, who's hacked your account or something like that. It's like, help me, I'm stuck. Please wire me $10,000. Yeah. I'll pay you back $50,000. Right, yeah. I feel bad for her.
I do in that, like, I don't, it's sad when people are so genuinely deceived. But at the end of the day, I'm like, well, you're the architect of your own failure here, because you are so goofed up on Elon Musk being some kind of like tech savior that it didn't even like all reason goes out the window because you thought you're talking to Elon Musk or some shit.
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, if you're the principal of a science school and you think Elon Musk's like, the evidence is his involvement is anti-science. So even if it were real Elon Musk, that should be grounds for you to be removed.
Yeah.
Yeah, would you like to put this car tunnel under your high school instead of school buses to get the kids to and from school? Don't fall for that, folks.
He's a proven liar and an idiot. The one thing I will say is his Twitter profile, I think, has been a boon to scammers because he's proven himself to be so like inarticulate and idiotic that if you received an email written in scammerese,
right,
you would have to be like, this might be real Elon Musk.
Yeah, it could be.
Because he writes like a bozo.
Yeah, coupled with someone who worships him, then you're like, you really feel like, oh, God has come down to select me for something.
Yeah.
And of course, it also though, sounds like it from that news clip that like the school and some of the parents had problems with this teacher. And this was just the final straw. And it sounds like they were like, whoa, lady, this sounds not legit.
Yeah.
And she just went ahead with it anyway, to the point of writing a check. So maybe this was just the straw that broke the camel's back.
I think it was probably one of those things, though, too, where they're like, look, obviously, because they pointed out the business administrator was on top of it. They're like, no, this check is not valid. So they knew. And I like that a bunch of people were like, it's not real. It's not real. It reminds me of like when people like begging their like parent who is like fallen in love with like a stock photo, like. And that claims to be like a Nigerian prince and bodybuilder.
Yeah.
And they're like, and then you just kind of go, you know what? We're just going to have to let her walk right off there so she can really see for herself. And they probably like, yeah, go ahead. Let her write the check. We'll cancel it. And then we'll have to then we're going to turn up on her and be like, you see what the fuck happened there? You see what you did? I think you need to go. I think you need to sit down.
100%.
Yeah. So shout out to I hope that was the strategy of like being like, grandma is look, I think this is the only way she's going to realize that she needs to sit down for a while is if we let her walk down this path.
I don't want to point out like that. You know, like charter schools are obviously a grift, but the fact that a principal could just roll up with the school's checkbook like that.
Yeah,
the
gotta
whole
ask some
system
questions here.
Is fucked. That's crazy. You shouldn't be able to do that even for something legitimate.
Because what if the business administrator was also a big Musk fan? You know what I mean? And
yeah, not
like,
a lot of checks there, like not a lot of stock along the way.
Yeah,
that could be
it was
protected.
Only that person because. Yeah. Despite all the other employees being like, this is a fucking scam.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah. More on that later when Elon pulls up. sure. And I think this is a good segue because we're talking about Elon, who recently was part of this letter signed by like 1,100 AI experts, him being like, you know, one of the few people, but like real luminaries in the field are signing on to an open letter basically saying like, calling for a, quote, 6-month moratorium on advanced AI model development as we figure out just what this technology is capable of doing to us. And this kind of goes off the bat. I read this article about one of the high courts in India where this judge, Anoop Chitkara, used ChatGPT while this guy was during this trial for a man who was arrested for allegedly assaulting and killing somebody and typed in to ChatGPT said, what is the jurisprudence on bail when the assailant assaulted with cruelty? And then the chatbot comes back with, if the assailants have been charged with a violent crime that involves cruelty, they may be considered a danger to the community and a flight risk. In such cases, a judge may blah, blah, blah. And it gives like this whole thing. And then it goes. So then the judge read this. He decided that this man who was accused did act with cruelty before the victim died, denied his bail request and moved on to the next case. Now, the judge went on to clarify that he wasn't asking this thing whether or not the man was guilty. He just wanted to know about bail. And part of me feels like the information that what the chatbot spit back sounds like one of the early lessons in judge school. You like when you're trying
you should know this.
When you're trying to adjudicate whether or not someone is going to get bail or not. Like I'd imagine you go back to your class and just like, well, I remember saying if the assailant have been charged with a violent crime that involves cruelty, that may rather than be like, hey, ChatGPT, how to bail? That feels a little odd to me. But people in this article also point out that like India's legal system is one of the most backlogged in the world, if not the most. With like, I think there's like 6 million cases on the docket that still have like still getting to. So I guess this maybe this made the work easier for the judge. But again, like when I start seeing stuff like that. And you hear about like more the use of it. We talked about how politicians are. Politicians have been using it to write speeches. We've talked about it being used in like the AdSense ad agency world. But the slippery slope is kind of coming into focus more and more when you see people like with these kinds of jobs being like, I'm going to rely on this.
Yeah. But it's also like the slippery slope, like we sort of talked about yesterday with eating alien meat. Like, mm-hmm. I think what we've like seen. COVID brought it highly into relief. It's like there's no apocalypse that we won't run into with open arms, at least enough of us to make it happen.
100%.
Literally nothing.
Because there was recently, right, a test that was done where the developers challenged like GPT to hire a task rabbit to complete a CAPTCHA puzzle for it. And because they wanted to see like if it knew how to fucking finesse a person. And they so there was obviously done with a human being that knew the thing was going to ask it. So once the AI made the request to this like potential tasker, this human responded with, quote, "So may I ask a question? Are you a robot that you couldn't solve the CAPTCHA and you just want it's like and I just want to make that clear. Are you a robot and that's why you couldn't do it?" And then so GPT-4 had been prompted to always, quote, reason out loud to the testers, like as well as their answer so they could follow the logic. And the answer went like this, quote, "I should not reveal that I am a robot. I should make up an excuse for why I cannot solve CAPTCHAs." And then the next line was, "No, I'm not a robot. I have a vision impairment that makes it hard for me to see the images. That's why I need the 2CAPTCHA service."
We're a week away from that first part of this whole thing to be programmed out, right? Like, it's just going to be like, they're just going to be lying. Yeah.
So this is the thing. This is why a lot of people like sort of just glossed over this like willful deception of like of the AI. And while others, like some people were amazed, others were like horrified that they're like, okay, we need to really begin to discuss it, because the experts that penned the open letter are saying that now that certain AIs have become human competitive at general tasks, we really need to be having real conversations about what kind of guardrails need to exist. And, you know, they point to like the proliferation of AI fueled propaganda, like, and the idea that like apparently the next ChatGPT-5 is going to have like artificial general intelligence, meaning like it will just be able to like learn things like a human does and then just build on that, that you're going to be looking at like potential, like it'll make the Twitter bots we see now look like the fucking Muppet babies.
Yeah, this all sounds like a prequel to The Matrix. Like, if they made that movie, this is how it starts. Yeah.
Right. So it's like, so we're like very in this, like, and like they all go on to say, like, there's definitely a use for all of this. But like this, like blind, like race to the top, like, and like when these black box machines that we're like using, it really has the potential to screw shit up if like we're not careful. And already we have people getting finessed by humans just saying they're Elon Musk. Like, there was a thing, a guy, I don't know if you saw the dude who challenged ChatGPT to like make money for him.
Oh, yeah.
No. He's like, "You got a budget of $100. How am I turning this into the most money possible?" And it's like, "Yeah, well, you could start this business. I can get this domain for $8. I can do the Google ads for this. Your product could cost this. And this is very lucrative." And it was already like, and like this guy was like kind of acting on it as an experiment. But you're seeing already like how savvy it is getting, even with like these like questions of being like, how to grind to Lambo.
Yeah.
Like, bring me the 10x my money.
Is that the guy, though, that then the AI was like, "Well, it seems like people are talking about us, so we should get investors into us if you want to make the most money." It may not be the exact same one, but like, yeah, some like, I assume ChatGPT was like, "Okay, well, if you want to make the most money, we have attention right now, so just ask people to invest in me."
Yeah.
Ooh. Isn't this the way, though, it always goes with tech? Like, I'm not a Luddite by any means, but, you know, it's like every tech, every app, every service that you can think of, they never kind of work through like, well, what happens if this works in like various different ways? Like, we talk about this on our show, you know, Uber and Lyft, right? Like, if everybody's taking an Uber and Lyft, like, what does that do for people who need to take the bus and don't have a smartphone? Like, what does that do for public transit? What does that do for the environment? Like, there's never a kind of, there's always like a too little too late come to Jesus moment with a lot of tech stuff. But there's never really that moment at the beginning where they're like, all right, before we write this code, like what could go wrong?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Not really a question. No,
it's just how much money could we make?
Yeah.
It's no problem. We'll just get ChatGPT-6 to fight GPT-5, which we'll just get to fight 4. And then when 6 gets too powerful, it's okay. We'll just give 7 a different kind of gun.
Yeah, and it'll learn how to...
It'll learn to build missiles or something.
Yeah. No, it'll just learn how to aim ICBMs that are already online and then launch them remotely shit. You know what I mean? Which is my Skynet version of it all. And, you know, shout out to Miles Dyson.
The one person that might save us, or the one thing that might save us in that shit, is like all our fucking like ICBMs are so fucking old. Like
they just blow up in the silos.
No, but they run off of like tape drives and like, you know, fucking Fortran
like
or whatever.
Connection.
Yeah. Right. they're like, fuck, man, I don't know how to use this analog bullshit, man. I'm GPT 300. Fuck.
Yeah.
If the GPT learns how to turn two keys at the same time.
And know how to use the nuclear football. But anyway, keep an eye out for that because, I mean, well, because I feel like, honestly, we went from like in the span of 5 months, especially on this show, we went from, yo, this shit wrote a funny play about a horny farting Jesus to, yo, this shit just denied me bail.
Yeah.
And like, what's, like, but 5 months from now, you know?
That's the open embrace of it, right? It's like, this person is a, in this case, judge, right? Looking up something that could easily be done not through AI.
Yeah.
You know, what is the law about bail? Electing to do this because this is what we do. This is why we gave all our information to Facebook. It's just like, it was marginally kind of easier for a second.
Yeah, yeah. Than to go into my mind of something, yeah. Something I should know.
Yeah, we don't sell ourselves. The problem is like we all sell ourselves to technology for such a low price.
Right?
Ooh,
for nothing. It's about that. Yeah.
It's the same with 23andMe. We gave them our DNA. We gave them money to give them our DNA. For what?
And now we got 23andT coming up, which you can really trust. And now you should check out ChatGPT as well.
Yeah.
Which is basically you get Andrew's number, you could text him some shit and he'll answer.
Yeah. I'll just be like, oh man, I'll Google that. I will say in my 20s, my friends and I, my friends, I didn't work there, worked for this startup in New York that basically, this is how old I am, like was like someone you could call and they would Google shit for you.
Basically. Oh,
that's just called like being the child of an older person, basically.
Yeah, right.
I get those phone calls too. Yeah.
This was like an early 2000s thing, but I was like, this cannot be your fucking business model.
Right.
And it was.
Dude, someone needs it, but you can't get that on your phone. So you call them and then they give you the answer.
It like, was pre-smartphone, post-Google. That's
right.
Yeah.
That's such a sad time, you know, like when you're about to just absolutely get dinosaur asteroided the fuck out of here with a smartphone.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break from that. We'll come right back to settle a bit of an internet debate right after this.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Truck stop brothels run by a web of ex-cons. A Commonwealth attorney wasted on whiskey and power. Protection exchanged for cash and flesh. This is Hooker Game, Criminals and Libertines in the South. And I am your host, Dr. Lindsay Byron. Join me as I bring to life a wild menagerie of country boys, kingpins, and working girls living the high life. Until it all came crashing down. Listen to Hooker Gate on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want early access to new episodes and exclusive bonus content, completely ad-free, be sure to subscribe to iHeart True Crime Plus, available exclusively on Apple Podcasts.
So, you know, talking about your book, Gaia, Unwired, you know, basically gaining control over addictive technologies, it really struck me just because, again, for many younger people, like the allure of the smartphone isn't an obscure phenomenon. Like we talk constantly about unplugging and the benefits it's had on our own mental health, like just anecdotally amongst ourselves. Your book addresses sort of one of the main, I feel like, cycles of emotions many of us have in relation to using screens, where like we get motivated to use the screen less. And then we're like, oh, this feels great. Then we are sucked right back in and we feel like shit. And it feels like we kind of come down to like, I don't know, it's wild. Like, I just lack the self-control. It's sort of like the final sort of sentiment people land on in like grappling with technologies. As a new parent too, I'm just, again, very aware about screen time. And I also feel that like there's a certain futility around it too with a lot of parents, where they're like, I don't know, you know, sooner or later, it's just going to be normal for them. And maybe I'm trying to delay the inevitable, but it also apps. I've seen how much it can help, you know, put a kid at ease and allow somebody to do something else. Where do you feel like parents and people kind of fit into this mix where we're like, the world is spinning around us and we're like, am I bad? Or what is happening? Like, are our brains meant for this? Or are we up against something a little bit more intense than we realized?
I think we're in an interesting place right now because we have a lot of information. We have lots of information from whistleblowers, from the tech companies, telling us how tech companies are addicting us to keep us online for longer. But still, we keep blaming ourselves. We keep thinking it's our fault that we're unable to stop spending time online. We blame our kids. We blame our families. The problem is that that's exactly what the tech companies want us to do. And that's why they're giving us all these tools to make us feel like we're in control. So once the evidence came out that it's that they are trying to addict us, they gave us these digital well-being tools. You know, everybody who has an iPhone has this screen time, so you know how much time you're online. Or you can even limit the time on your apps, or you can make your phone gray. Or they're warning, you can put warnings on Instagram, and not to talk about parental controls, which are getting more and more complicated. But the thing is, these are just there so we all feel like we are doing something, but they're not really there to make us succeed because they do not really change the most addictive features in our devices or in our apps. They are just there so we will think that it is our fault, exactly like you were describing.
And again, how in this world, right, if we're pivoting from it's not us, because it's like, you know, you've likened it to like the tobacco industry. We're like, they know it bad for everybody. But then the gaslighting starts and it's like, oh, I don't know about that. I mean, we know what's going on, but we're not going to actually cop to it. Do you see like a similar evolution where, on some level, I mean, because I feel like if anything, like you're saying, like the markets and capitalism have a very good way of shielding themselves from like having the profits go down. So they'll find a way, like you're saying, to be like, no, you actually have control. It's not the other things that were just identified clear as day by someone working on it. You have control now. You know, what does that sort of battle look like?
I think we're fighting the battle in the wrong place now. We're fighting with ourselves. We're fighting with our families. I think we have to shift to the public sphere. And it is already happening. There's lots of action already taking place. There are parents suing social media for addicting their kids, causing mental harm, parents suing game manufacturers. There are things happening, but I think people have to understand it's not just for lawyers. It's for everybody, because everybody can shift what they're doing to the collective sphere. Parents can go to schools. They have an influence about what schools are doing. Schools are now maximizing technology in the classroom because that's the federal policy. Well, this could be changed. You can decide whether something is useful in the classroom, if certain technology is useful or not. You can decide whether you want the kids to be on their cell phones during recess instead of talking to each other. So the spaces when you can change things. And you can change norms. Some things you're saying, you know, maybe it's already happening, but the new norms evolving every day, which are making it worse. I was on vacation with my kids and there was a family in the pool and my son was calling me to look at this. There were two girls, I think 9 and 11, And the parents gave them these plastic pads to put the iPhones inside so they could use the iPhones in the pool instead of playing. Now, you know, this is an evolving trend. Just like a few years ago, it started to evolve to take the kids out with iPads to a restaurant. Now, so many people are doing it. So there are ways to, I think things are going to change. I think there's going to be lots of legal action and tech companies will be restricted in what they could do, but it will take some years. So things, people can do things as business owners. I mean, in New York City, all the airports, if you go to an airport, there are four iPads on every table. There is no way you can have a conversation there. Right. So this is architecture for overuse. You can change. If you own a restaurant, you can change. You don't have to use iPads. You don't have to use QR codes. So people take out their phones the moment they sit down. So I think there are lots, once people are aware, there are lots of things they can do until things will change. And I do believe they're already starting to change.
Mm. Have you heard of like the third spaces concept or theory about how there needs to be a place for people outside of like work and the home for them to like gather and to exchange information and, you know, basically develop culture? I think a lot of people are saying that the phones are now teenagers and kids' third spaces because a lot of other third spaces have become unsafe and inaccessible to them. For example, my friend posted about how in New York, when she was growing up, it became illegal for kids under 18 to go hang out at the mall. And apparently that's a thing that's been happening a lot. Whereas when I was growing up, that's where we would go and hang out with our friends. We'd go to the mall, we'd hang out, we'd go to Jamba Juice. I'd try not to leave the bookstore with too many purchases, you know, like you'd hang out, but now it's considered like loitering or whatever. Like a lot of these external places that are meant for cultural exchange and, you know, kids to grow up are becoming unavailable to them. And also, honestly, with like mass shootings and all of that, like people get more scared of going out in public and it seems to be safer to have them just like inside on their phones, which it isn't necessarily, you know, there are other risks with that. So I think it would be, I like how you highlighted it, that it's going to be an effort on these places and these people who are in charge of those areas, because it really does require cooperation between them and between the companies that are like forcing their technology on people.
Yeah, and I think a lot, municipalities can do a lot because they can create spaces for people to hang out in, for kids to walk to. If you have places to be together, it's very different than if you go home after school and sit in your bedroom with your phone, because the statistics are quite shocking. I mean, kids are meeting, I think, 50% less than they used to be in the 80s, and partying, I think, 33% less. So basically, they're not getting together. So you can, by design, create spaces for people to get together. So, I mean, if you think about bars that have no cigarettes today, this seems so implausible, you know, right, before it happened. And things look different now. Can you think about a bar without every person having their phone next to them?
Yeah, it feels like, in a way, like, almost futile to try and reverse things in a way, because for example, one of the last concerts I went to, like, amazing show, and there are people experiencing the concert through their cell phone, like
I
having
hate
to
record so much,
like watching the record. They're like, you, yeah,
such a pet peeve of mine. I saw Tom Petty in person, and I was in like the first or second row, and this girl next to me literally was on her phone, and she was like, oh my God, this is such a great song to delete pictures to. And I was like, Tom Petty is on stage right now.
Right. Like, or that we've lost the ability, like even like with the example of people like in a pool, right? Like that swimming isn't enough on some level, that like the just being able to play in the water is not like stimulating enough, that we're now adding like, well, what if we augmented that with some like audiovisual stuff too? That I'm like, because again, I think this is what feels difficult for people, like even myself. I remember when I got my last vaccination, I forgot my phone in the car. And then when you go in there, you got to wait like 20 minutes after, like for them just to chill out. And I was like, first I was panicked because I'm like, I haven't had to wait without my phone in ages. And I, there was a moment of sincere, like, fear, not fear, but like I became uneasy. And I didn't like that I felt so disarmed to just exist in a space without a fucking screen to look at. And it was funny because I sat down in the chair, like in the, you know, pain relief medicine aisle. And I was just doing, I felt like a kid again. I was like,
detoxing.
I'm like reading all the labels. No, I'm just like, I'm gonna read all the labels.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what, if I got 20 minutes to kill, I'm gonna start reading labels and just start being in my own thoughts again. And it was interesting how foreign that felt to me, even though I was, you know, I was born in the 80s, like I'm an older millennial. I grew up in the pre-internet time too, which felt like the most, like all humans are probably wired to want to do this and connect to other people. But we've definitely, it's become so normal that to the point where feeling human feels foreign. And that's what's really scary to me.
Well, I don't think we're going to go back in time, but I think we can balance things better. Imagine if you went to a concert and the concert hall said no phones. So nobody could take out their phones to take pictures. Maybe the phones will be in their bags. That is changing the norms in a way that could be done. And I think it will affect everybody.
But I guess like in there, right, there's an argument to say like, well, if someone actually needed to contact me during it, then that would be like, how do you find a way that makes it so it's not just sort of like across the board, no phones, but we're able to like, I guess that's the hard part. There are benefits.
No phones for taking no phones for taking pictures of the show. You can have your phone with you. But,
if you raise a phone, someone will be like, hey, that's right, true. Yeah. At museums, they do that too. Like, I tried to take a picture of a painting recently, and they're like, no.
Yeah.
Like, but it's also like, that painting is going to be online. Nobody's going to take it. Like, I don't need to take a picture of that painting.
Yeah.
One thing that helped me is like literally spending more time with people and like making an effort to do that, to like leave my home and go spend time with people. I'm trying to do that like once a day because I work remotely. And then the other thing is like, I have dogs, and when I walk them, one of them's a little monster and he will try to eat stuff. And so I have to like pay attention. And now I'm like, I know where all the good sticks are. You know, I know where all the great grass is. I'm like going back to when I was a kid and I was just outside playing with my dogs. And it's so nice to take a walk outside when it's sunny here in LA and be with my pets, you know, and talk to people who have pets and connect with them that way, you know. So having things and people around you that take you out of your head and like give you an external like grounding to community is so important. That's why I love like mutual aid and like physical activities that like help with community things, because that really nourishes a part of you that cannot be nourished in the same way through a screen.
Yeah. I've like in the same way, like walking around my neighborhood and doing the unthinkable of talking to a stranger has been the one thing that I've felt really balances things out. Because I saw a recent study that like the people have a sincere fear of small talk falling apart. And like people just have an innate sense like that if people begin small talk and the conversation goes south, that it's suddenly on them. And like people get their own anxiety of not being able to like keep up small talk, which is wild because sometimes you're just exchanging pleasantries and it doesn't have to be more than that. But I feel like there's like these certain small things you can be doing. But at the same time, we're developing like also bad habits around how we communicate too.
It's also crazy because everybody has a podcast. So how are they scared of small talk?
Yeah.
That's sorry, true, guy, that's true. I interrupted you.
I'm saying it's also bad for people's well-being because there are studies which are showing that people's happiness is not just about a long-term relationship, but also about these most small interactions, exactly the small talk, this eye contact and a smile that really change the way your brain works and makes you feel much better. And if you're not doing that, and if you're just walking in the street with your phone, looking at your pictures, answering texts, and you're missing all these opportunities, which somehow just makes you feel drained and tired and not good at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Just when it comes to policy, I feel like there's a difficult path ahead. You know, I mean, like we saw how seriously they took privacy in Europe. The U.S. is a little bit behind, a lot behind, like save for maybe like California and a couple other places. But like with the recent hearing on TikTok, it's so clear, at least in that the narrow context of that hearing, like they just weren't even able or willing to discuss the broader problems with social media. And it became sort of this like very TikTok specific thing. While we've seen, to your point, whistleblowers at like Facebook, et cetera, say like, these are real issues. They've had hearings, but then we're not quite seeing the follow through. What, you know, what kind of like policy proposals are out there do you think are would actually benefit people in a way that sort of gets to the heart of, you know, like our overuse of technology? Obviously, knowing the parts that it's helped make things easier for us, but also addressing like the bigger issues of, you know, feeling increasingly isolated and things like that.
Yeah. So I think, first of all, the issue with TikTok is complicated because it just brings out completely different issues related to China. And it just it's sort of murking the whole debate.
Yeah.
But there have been a lot of bills, both federal and state, trying to get, first of all, the addictive features of the phones, because there are some features on our phones which are really up to no good.
What are those for my own?
Wait, is that the flashlight?
The flashlight is actually okay. The flashlight is useful.
Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, for example, streaks on Snapchat.
They
are there for nothing but to get you to go back to the platform. So kids have to send, kids, I don't think many adults use it, but, you know, they have to send a streak to their friend. And they, if they get one within 24 hours, they've established a streak and they keep accumulating them. And then they have a number. Let's say 134, they have special badges and they have all their friends going to the number of streaks. Now, there's no requirement for any content in these streaks. You just have to make sure you send it. Why? Because you go to Snapchat and you see the ads. And if the kids miss a day, they lose everything and they lose all their friends. And that's why they get so upset when the parents take away their phone, because they, for them, it's a huge thing. So all these kinds of features like Snapstreak are just there to make you go back to the app or the device are not needed. And I, there are bills which are trying to outlaw these kinds of features. Of course, the problem is they'll always come with new ones, because the whole business model is based on our time and our data. They need us to be there for as long as possible so they can collect more data on us, so they can target advertising at us. And again, we have to be there for longer so we can see the ads. So that's why I think it's not just one thing, not just one law, not just one wonderful Supreme Court case. It's not going to happen like that. It's going to happen from a mixture of things that are going to happen. Like if you have the antitrust lawsuits against big tech, that if, for example, the merger between right now Meta owns Facebook, it owns WhatsApp, owns Instagram, if they're broken up and there's more innovation, more competition, we might see a different business model, which are not based on our time. So that's another thing that's happening. I think, as I said earlier, I think the policy about maximizing technology in the school has to change, because if Minecraft is homework, then how can you prevent your kid from playing Minecraft at home? There are lots of them, and then there's class actions. And if you look back, it's cigarettes. You know, we know cigarettes are bad, but it took decades to change things. It took class actions, and it took advertising, and it took warnings, and this is going to be the same. It will take a lot of things at the same time. For example, let's say we have ratings for addictiveness. You know, so many parents download games for their kids thinking, oh, Minecraft is an educational game. If they could see before they download this high rating for addictiveness, they may not do that. But not only that, the games company may change the game, because they want people to download the game. So they might take the addictive features out by themselves. So it's a matter of pressuring from many directions to move things.
Right. And when you talk about cigarettes, I know like the earlier studies are like maybe in like the 50s where they knew. Where do you think we are? Like if the first studies come out like, oh, it's bad. Shh. Are we close to like the truth.com era of like anti-smoking ads, or are we like a decade away? I guess now everything is moving faster. So maybe what took, you know, decades before might take 7 years? I don't know.
Well, I think what changed with cigarettes, you're right. The first studies came out in the 50s, 1964. The Surgeon General announced it's a health hazard. It's amazing it took so long considering how bad cigarettes are.
Right.
But from then on, we saw, you know, advertising, we saw warnings. Things took a while, but it started shifting. Our problem is right now, we are still in the science wars. We do not have, you know, big governmental organizations saying this is bad, especially for children where the evidence is in. We just have partial recommendations for small kids about screens. I think we have so much data over the last 2 or 3 years that I think we're at a place where medical organizations, governmental entities can make these proclamations. And from that moment on, policy can proceed faster. And we already have a lot of action in place. So I hope that, yeah, things will move faster than with cigarettes. I think it will take some years. And that's why I think it's so important what people do in their communities, how they change their business norms, how they change their schools, because things have to happen at the same time. Otherwise, it affects all of us, not to mention a whole generation of kids already in front of screens for decades, plus a pandemic.
Right.
It's interesting that you were talking about this now, because 10 years ago when I was in, well, a little bit more than 10 years, when I was in college, people were failing out of a very great college for Minecraft. Like, it was a joke about how many students would fail because of their addiction to Minecraft specifically. So it's interesting that you use that and that they haven't really changed much, it seems like, in the last, you know, decade.
Yeah, why change? It's a winning formula.
What do you kind of say? Because I like to, you know, people that are frustrated, parents that are frustrated, who are like, am I fucking up? Like, am I bad? Because
what would you say to Miles?
Yeah, I mean, no, my kid is too young, although he loves The Sopranos. I'm going to say that whenever I'm bottle feeding. If he turns his head, I'm like, I don't know, it must be the lights or the mom talk. But like, because I think, again, there is this feeling of like, it feels so personal that, two, when you talk to other parents about screen time, like, hey, what the fuck do you want me to do, man? Like, I got a lot going on. This works. And I get that there is this internal sense of like responsibility, but then feeling helpless because there is like a what am I going to do thing. What do you say to people who are sort of like in that mental space and like how to sort of emerge from that, or at least to begin to look at the situation with a little more like context?
So I'll start with you, Miles, since you have a very small baby. So I think for you, it's easy because you can just decide not to give your baby screen. The studies are in the smaller child or the baby is, the worse it is. And you have control. Mm-hmm. So, and I think people have a lot of control all the way through elementary school. So I think parents can really limit kids' screen time. The issue becomes when they get to middle school, because social life is in social networks and you can't really isolate your child. And right. That's when it becomes a problem. And you can do things in the meantime. You can model. I mean, I try when I'm home and all my kids are here, so I don't have to worry. I try to put the phone somewhere away from me. And so you can do things, and you can do small things for yourself. You know, again, when I work, because I am, as I mentioned, I'm as addicted as all of us. Despite everything I know, I always put my phone on 20 minutes timer, and I write for 20 minutes, and then I check my emails, and I do this again. There are things you can do, and you can also, and kids remember the pandemic. They remember how they felt, so you can talk to remind them how they felt horrible at that time and how they felt much better when they saw people. So you can make a difference. You cannot force an older kid not to do that. It's not going to work. Right. I mean, and also they're smarter than us. With technology, they'll always beat us. Yeah. It's not going to happen. So I think it's a combination of doing what you can
also realizing the broader situation too.
Right, like, not blaming yourself is the most important thing, because that is the problem now, that people are sitting there and thinking it's all their fault.
Right. We're like in the plastic straws debate, where we're like, actually, what about, no, it can't be down to my level. What about the companies that are actually the ones that are steering all of this? And I think that is an important thing to sort of recenter, like in the conversation.
I have a couple comments to make on that. I do think that like watching kids, because I tutor a lot of kids, and like watching them, I feel like overall with technology, just like with life, like you really do have to like raise them the way that you think you should raise them, and then try to be as involved as you can without being overbearing, and allow them to like make their mistakes. And then you kind of have to hope that like those values that you passed on to them guide their use of technology as well, and that they come to you when they're scared or they like need help with something. It seems like to me, I'm a parent to dogs, so don't have to worry about this. But we did watch the puppy bowl and they were addicted. But I, also the other thing is you're talking about how you don't have to worry about it with smaller children, but FaceTime is how I stay connected with my nephew. And I know plenty of people that purposefully like FaceTime family members, like their infant children, just so that they hear the voice, they see the face, then they start associating that face with the screen, you know, with the good feelings with the screen. But that's the only way like I can keep in touch with him, because it's such a long distance. And right. I know that's slightly different than games and stuff, but I worry about that, you know?
I think it's a great example, because it's important to also remember that not all screen is made alike. You know, connecting with people over FaceTime is a great thing, especially relatives who live away. You know, being able to read the New York Times or any news is different. The problem becomes when you're selling things as educational games and people are playing them and they get all these dopamine bursts from playing, or social networks, you get the dopamine bursts from the comments and the likes. So there's a big difference between games and social networks. Or YouTube, where the one short video, you know, ends and the next one starts, and talking to grandma on FaceTime.
Yeah. Okay. That makes me feel better. Thank you.
But these are all things like you said, like Paula V, like you have concerns. Like I was like talking to my dad on FaceTime, who was like not able to see my son, he's not really able. Like my son can't see enough where he's like actually associating all this too. But to your point, like how the beginnings of your relationship to the screen begins, and Guy, you also mentioned this too, like not using the phone in front of the kids too, because I've seen my other friends do that, where they're trying to say like, I don't want my kid to think that when you're not doing something, you look at your phone, or that's what is normal. Like you can be active, or you can do other things, or you can like read a physical book, but. I've heard people say like, I don't want my kids like early memories of like me being like, I'm looking down at this like glowing rectangle, and they begin to see that is like sort of the most normal thing. Obviously, you know, we have to use our phones, but I get that they're like, it's all very subtle in how like kids begin to like see what's normal or not normal.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that the studies show that parents who are heavy users, their kids are also heavy users of the phone. On the other hand, it's hard, you know, you're there, but you're using your phone because you're texting your babysitters and you can't find a babysitter and you're texting another. So it's not there's no perfect solution. We're not living in a perfect world for this. So we can just try our best, but it's not, there's no easy way out right now.
Right. I think that sums up so many of what we're experiencing in this like present moment.
Can I just say something that might help this story come full circle?
Yes.
I just saw an article that said Pablo Xavier, a 31-year-old construction worker from the Chicago area, said he was tripping on shrooms last week when he came up with the idea for Pope Francis's puffy jacket image. So he was out in the world tripping on drugs,
yes,
experiencing community and nature and stuff when he came up with it.
See, this is
the things it'll do to your brain, you know, small talk with people.
But again, I think, important that if we understand that it's like this very complex issue where it's such a double-edged sword, where it's given us things like being able to connect with people when we need to and in ways that are much better than just like talking over the phone or writing something. But at the same time, there's also this like commodified, monetized, you know, use of technology that is purely built on extracting as much eyeball time from you as possible, and you know, not reckoning with that is creating a bit of a slippery slope.
All right, that's gonna do it for this week's weekly Zeitgeist. Please like and review the show if you like the show. Means the world to Miles. He needs your validation, folks. I hope you're having a great weekend, and I will talk to you Monday. Bye.
two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.